This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Project Blue Book is in the news big time right now. There is a show on the History Channel. It's pretty amazing. It's partly fiction, but based on reality. But what is that reality? Well, today we're going to be talking to Dr. Irina Scott, who has actually walked down the corridors and passageways where UFO studies took place in the past. She worked in several crucial UFO investigatory agencies. This is inside information we're talking today. This is not secret. We're not violating the law, but we're talking about this at a level that you don't often hear, maybe never. We're going to be talking about things like memory metal, the Elroy John Center. You don't know who he is, but you're going to find out. The Cordell Hull Report, the Battelle Memo, many different extraordinary things. Dr. Scott, Irina, welcome to Dreamland.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's really exciting to have you because you were basically on the inside of this stuff, very much so. Now, I thought that we might start with the I think we should start at the beginning. A number of Air Force personnel connected to the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, received debris that has been brought out from Roswell, New Mexico on a B-29 bomber. Now, this is a very huge question, but believe me, folks, we're gonna focus in. Irina, what happened then?
It was brought in on a B-29 bomber, and what I found out was from talking to somebody at Dayton, a person that was familiar with Wright-Patterson from way back and familiar with Wright Field, which later turned into Wright-Patterson, that there's a series of hangars by what used to be the old runway to Wright Field. And people have talked about Hangar 18 and located it as a building 18, in a different place at Wright-Patterson. But this person told me that where the plane actually landed and unloaded was a hangar. And I checked, there's a series of five hangars in a row. He said it was the second one from the left, and that's where the plane unloaded the debris and whatever else was from Roswell. And this made sense after I looked up more information, because it was there when the B-29 landed, and there was a runway right there in front of it, so it's logical that that's where the plane would probably unload.
Now, so, yeah, that is, so the plane unloads this debris, and now let's fast forward to the question of what was in the debris. Specifically, let's talk about the metal that was there, because as you probably know, Jacques Vallée has been doing some publicly available research into pieces of metal. I had some of them at one time that have some very strange qualities. Their isotopic ratios don't work. In other words, they're not isotopes from this planet or any place in this universe. And yet the metallic objects are stable. Now, what kind of metal was it that was so strange that that came out of that plane from Roswell?
It's been described as memory metal, and it's a metal that can be bent, but it will resume its old form after it's bent, so it changes back into whatever it was to start with. And I've heard different things about it, that in one test at Wright State University, which is by Wright-Patterson, I heard that people tried to shoot it, and the bullets wouldn't go through.
That's what General Exon told me, the same thing. And, of course, Jesse Marcel, in his videotape of what they did with it while at Roswell, says they shot a .45 pistol into it and it didn't go through.
That's what they did for an experiment. That's what I was told that they did for an experiment at Wright State University.
Right, which I think General Exon probably witnessed. Now, but something is terribly wrong here. We get this extraordinary material. We get bodies. And frankly, we did get bodies. I know it for personal reasons. I know it for certain. And can you tell us anything you may know about those bodies?
Well, I've heard different things. And I have secondhand information that they're, I think in general, they say there were four of them. They were small, with big eyes and large heads, and just looked like a standard graze or something. But I got some information from another person that was talking to a doctor that she said was telling that he was there, and called in to examine him. He was a dermatologist. And he was supposed to examine their outside covering. But when I called him, he said he didn't do anything like that. So I don't know. But apparently, something was definitely flown from Roswell to Wright-Patterson and delivered there. And they said they took him to several places, including buildings and vaults underneath Wright-Patterson.
Have you found any evidence of the existence of those places?
I found several examples of evidence, because most of the other authors, Wright-Patterson is very, very secured, and you can't just walk in. And hardly any ufologists have been there. In fact, maybe one or two. So it's not a place where you can just go and snoop around. But I had passed several times to go in. And when I was there, I took some pictures and I looked at what other people had reported from informant information, and then looked at the actual sites myself and took some pictures. One story is that they were taken to Building 18, which they sometimes call Hangar 18, on Wright-Patterson. And also there's a building right beside it called either Hangar or Building 23. And I've driven by both of them and looked them over to see, you know, if there's doors or things like that. And I think the general story is that the material was taken to Building 23 and put in a basement, and then a covering was put over the basement, and then a connection was made between Building 23 and Building 18, and Building 18 had an underground passage to Building 23. Well, when I was there, I didn't go out of the car and look around because I was afraid I'd get in trouble. But I noted that Building 18, on the side toward Building 23, the basement windows are blocked so you can't see in. And that kind of made me wonder if maybe there is a passage in there and a basement place in Building 18.
Yeah, it sounds like there might be. But, you know, there's so many things here. For example, let's talk a little bit about the Batal memo and what it means and what it meant to someone like Jacques Vallée. Why don't you tell us first about what the memo is, what it says?
Well, Project Blue Book is a famous study, and all the attention has been given to the examination of witnesses. Like if somebody saw a UFO, well, the Project Blue Book people may come out and investigate, and that's what is usually shown. But there's another part of Project Blue Book, and that's the real meat of the project. And that is that what they did with all the data from that they collected during the investigations. And that was a top secret study done by Battelle Memorial Institute that they tried to keep it secret, although that's pretty amazing that they would. And it was a component of Blue Book that nobody even knew about, even the people in Blue Book, except for the people that were doing the investigation of it. And it was a statistical study of their data. And what was really amazing about it was is that it they did statistics on the data from the investigation, and it came out to like less chance than 1 billion in 1 that UFOs are a real phenomenon, that they're not just prosaic objects like misidentified airplanes and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Obviously there are real phenomenon, but there's something began to happen not too long after that. The CIA came into this with a different attitude. Could you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, as to disclosure.
Well, that was something I thought was very strange is that when they were really collecting good data and they had just really fine data from a whole lot of sources, and this was also after UFOs had been spotted over Washington, D.C. in 1952, and the study came out positive and everything. Well, they suddenly closed the investigation, apparently, and it seemed really mysterious because it seemed like when they were right up to finding out things, they closed everything.
Yeah, absolutely. But why would they do that?
Okay. It seemed very strange that they ended right when they had really good data that positively showed that UFOs existed, such as they had this study, the Battelle study, showing that there's one chance out of maybe a trillion that UFOs are a real phenomenon. And some of the data they had when they closed it were came from an example called Mainbrace, which was a study by, it was a NATO study, I think, and they thought there were devices that monitored this Mainbrace, which was a big NATO exercise that took a lot of countries. And they had a photographer on one of the ships that was taking good pictures of a UFO. These are secret. Nobody's ever seen them. And that caused some commotion. And they were so nervous about it that they started preparing because they were going to have set off the first H-bomb. And they were preparing on a Project Ivy that they were making preparations, and that was in case UFOs showed up at the H-bomb test. So it was quite a big thing. And they called that, they actually said that the possible UFO had been monitoring them, which suggested that it was something intelligent watching what was going on. And so it was a big thing. And they had evidence from Wright-Patterson, Battelle, the Air Force, the Pentagon, NATO, and a large group of exercises and information. And then right when they had that, they closed the study. And that was just made no sense to me at all.
Well, exactly. And in the book, in Sacred Corridors, you talk about a number of possible reasons for this, one of which is particularly interesting to me. And Free Dreamlanders, when we get back, we're going to be talking about those very subjects. We'll be right back.
Dreamland, founded by Art Bell, now hosted by Whitley Strieber, on unknowncountry.com and TuneIn Radio. A listener says, interviews like the most incredible stories you've ever been told. Riveting. Join Dreamland and the unknowncountry.com community. Listen free on unknowncountry.com and TuneIn Radio. Podcasts run for a week starting Fridays. Don't miss Whitley Strieber's beautiful new book, The Journey to Dog Heaven. Bob was a ranch dog when his master Buddy went off to war. Bob followed on what became a heart-stopping adventure. Readers love it. One says, beautiful, deeply affecting. Another, rarely have I been so exalted by a book. Get the ebook for $4.99. The audiobook is available from audible.com. A dog's love is forever.
We're talking to Irina McCammon Scott. Dr. Scott has been behind the scenes in the world of UFO secrets, and she's got a lot to tell us about. This week, we're talking about her book, Sacred Corridors, Secrets Behind the Real Project Blue Book, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Roswell, the Vatau Organization, Memory Metal, J. Allen Hynek, and UFO Cover-Ups. Now, on page 194 of the book, she asks the most important question, why kill the study? Then later in the show, we're going to get into what was killed. But right now, let's find out why. Why would these scientists make such a gross error? They knew there was something to study here, and yet spigot was turned off. Irina, what do you have to say about this?
Well, I don't know, because I had notes from Mattel that said, they'd studied the study, actually. And I had a number of handwritten notes that say, well, they just turned it off and quit right there when they had all the information. And I didn't understand that at all. It was phrased as the whole trend of things explode and UFO research on UFOs is ruined forever. Was quote from their notes. And that was right when they had a lot of information. And besides that, it was after the Washington flyby. And that was really interesting, too, because in 1952, there were a big flyby over the White House and everything. Of UFOs. In fact, they were studying UFOs at the Pentagon, and the flyby was over the places where they were studying them, which it made me kind of wonder if somebody got scared or something.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I'm wondering. You mentioned Bender, Albert Bender. Can you tell us a little bit about what he found out and planned to do, but didn't?
Well, he had started a bureau, an international flying saucer bureau, and he was the very first person, I think, that started any type of international organization to explore UFOs. And the descendants of that are like MUFON and all the big UFO organizations. And he had been exploring and studying, and he had a news bulletin he was putting out, a publication. So it was a big thing back then. It was the only big thing about to investigate UFOs, aside from the government. And he found out all about UFOs, and he was going to make an announcement in a month or so and explain the whole secret. Well, then something terrified him. I guess he might have had a visit from Men in Black or something. I'm not real sure. but something just absolutely terrified him. And he got completely out of the field. And he was a famous beginner of everything like that. And he just died a couple of years ago. And he stayed so out of everything that nobody even knew who he was. And he just died recently. He was in his 90s. And he had not said anything since the 1960s, I think.
You know, that's not, he's not the only person who has done something like that. In the book, you mention, could something in the government have come under the control of the phenomenon? Can you expand on that theory?
Well, I said that, and I know it says it sounds very paranoid, but I had some adventures when I worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency that made me wonder if something way up in the government is over the UFO studies. But a scientist named Harley Rutledge did an intensive study in 1973 in Missouri of UFO phenomena, and he reported that there seemed to be some kind of metal leak between UFOs and people's minds. And he was a scientist. This has been totally, you know, with other witnesses and equipment and everything else. And I had some experiences, too, that made me also wonder about that. And so I was very curious if someplace up in the government, somebody might be under the influence of the UFO phenomena.
Now, just hold on. Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take another break, and we're going to expand on this a lot when we come back. We'll be right back.
Whitley Strieber is the legendary author of Communion, Transformation, The Grays, Superstorm with Art Bell, and so many more. You can find out more on his author website, Strieber.com. Get his great new Journey to Dog Heaven, his classics, The Wolfen, Transformation, rarities like The Wild, and so many more. Strieber.com. And join Whitley on his Facebook group, Supernatural. Follow him on Twitter, Whitley Strieber, author of Wonder.
We're talking to Irina McCammon Scott. Her new book, Sacred Corridor, Secrets Behind the Real Project Blue Book, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Battelle, Memory Metal, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and UFO cover-ups. And next week, we're going to be going even deeper into Inside the Lightning Ball, scientific study of lifelong UFO experiencers, which she has also just published. And so she will be with us for 2 weeks. Now, you were in the Defense Intelligence Agency. You began to get the feeling that there was something far above where your level that was kind of calling the shots. Would that be accurate?
Well, I put it in my book as a speculation. And this is because I had a above top secret clearance, a code word clearance. And I was working on an air order of battle section at that time. And it was satellite photography. And we were working over a particular area of the Earth, and we were supposed to identify anything flying in the air from the photography. And that's not that it was a scientific job, and I was a GS 11, which was up in the PhD level. And while I was working in that section, my sister and I had a really weird experience with UFOs, and I was sort of fly-piably sane because I had that clearance and everything. And so you don't go around in a job like that and say, oh, I see UFOs. But I was very disturbed about it. And I came in sometime a day or two later and just offhandedly mentioned UFOs. I mean, I didn't say I saw anything, but I just mentioned it. In my section, I expected everybody to harass me and fall off their chairs laughing and everything. But they didn't. And what they said was is that just before I had come into the section, they had actually turned in a report saying that they had seen a UFO on our film. And we were supposed to be the authorities. I mean, we were supposed to be on that area of ground and the authorities on anything that was flying in the air. And so they reported it. And what they said was is that the higher-ups told him that it was a spot on the film. And it wasn't, because, for one thing, it was on two different missions. The mission is when the satellite goes around the world in 90 minutes. And they had it on two different missions. It was in a slightly different place, but it looked like the same thing. And I even enlarged it and changed its shape, size, and everything, and I could see it in stereo.
Can you describe it for us?
Well, I don't know if exactly, because that wasn't exactly what it was, the way you usually studied it, but I got so I could see it in stereo, and it was a round disc-shaped thing with a big dome, and it looked like just like, you know, like covering an airplane or something. So it was definitely there, and it was definitely on two missions. And the higher-ups just insisted that it was a flaw in the film, even though we had two pictures of it. And my supervisor sent the film to a specialist, and they said it wasn't a flaw in the film. And this was, you know, a professional job, and if they disagreed with our with what it was identified as, they should have discussed it with him and come up with a good discussion and said why they thought this. But they didn't. They just insisted that it was a flaw in the film, which was just treating, you know, my supervisors like they were nobodies.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They're treating your supervisors
like
children.
Yeah, like they treat the public, you know, when they say you didn't see this. But we had, you know, film and evidence and everything else. The film is still classified, actually. I mean, all of it that we used is.
It's still classified, you know, and yet it was supposedly nothing, a flaw in the film. Yeah. So we can't see the classified flaw in the film.
No.
Now, here's an interesting question for you. Why would this be? Because I can see from the earlier, from the material of in your book, that there were a lot of plans and expectations that once this was figured out, they were going to go public with it. They seemed to just to sort of assume that. And yet, that's not what happened.
Well, that's what I couldn't figure out. And in the government, if you get it, the levels above top secret are code word clearances, and a code word goes for some particular type of work, and they don't go, you don't just get a code word and go to all everything above top secret. There's just particular types of work you do with particular code words, and if UFOs were under some particular code word, well, only people that worked under those code words would know it. And the type of job I had, we should have known about UFOs because we were supposed to identify everything over this area.
Exactly.
But we didn't.
That information was kept from you.
Well, it was kept from us. I assume there was information someplace by the way they acted, that because it wasn't logical.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating and very strange. But it means that this is a cover-up is involved, and it's a very high-level cover-up.
That was my impression.
Yes. And that gets me back to the question of who's doing that. Because I know people and work with people who are involved in this now, and there is something that they can't get a handle on. And I wonder if you have ever had any evidence that you could point to that there was someone at a non-human, in other words, not us, who is actually calling the shots from within the government.
That was the only evidence I could think of. And at the time and ever since then, I've wondered, I thought maybe the office might be in the CIA, because I think our reports eventually went to the CIA, but that's speculation. And I just thought, you know, there's something going on here that's strange. But at the time, I wouldn't have talked about having sightings or anything because I was working for the DIA and you don't go around doing that. And right. So I didn't report until later anyway. But that was just my impression that something way up in the government that was quite a bit above us. I think my supervisor might have been a GS-14, I'm not sure. But he was pretty high. And it was above them. It was above my supervisors.
And how powerful a clearance did your supervisor have?
I thought he probably had the same one I did. Uh-huh. I didn't.
You can ask. Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take another short break, and then we're going to get down deep into the question of the why of this cover-up. Because it's there. There's no question about it anymore. It's there. We'll be right back.
You've probably heard the music for years. It's the theme song for Dreamland. But you may not know the name of the piece, The O of Pleasure. Or the name of the composer, Ray Lynch. Ray Lynch is a 3-time Billboard Award winner. Ray is also the composer of the platinum album, Deep Breakfast. Pandora calls Ray one of the most influential artists in New Age pop and adult alternative circles. For music that will move your heart and set your spirit soaring, visit www.raylynch.com.
They are found deep in a dying jungle, 6 infants. They aren't apes. They aren't human either, not quite. So, what are they? When they are spirited off to the United States, an incredible discovery is made. They are as smart as us, but not us, not human. The company that found them wants to buy and sell them as the most valuable animals on Earth, brilliant workers who need not be paid. Somebody has to stop this travesty, and that's where primatologist Beth Cook comes in. But can she stand up to the power and wealth that seeks to exploit them? Find out in Whitley Strieber's first standalone science fiction novel in 7 years. New. Get it on Amazon as an ebook or paperback.
We're talking to Irina McCammon Scott about her book, Sacred Corridors, Behind the Real Project Blue Book, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Roswell, Battelle, Memory Metal, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and UFO Cover-Ups. And we have been exploring the question of whether or not there is somewhere in the government a level of control that is from outside the human world. And, you know, I want to bring something up, Irina, and if you know nothing about it, we'll just go past it. But a couple of years ago, there was a very strange thing that happened in the Antarctic. The then Secretary of State, the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, and an astronaut all went down to Antarctica for some reason. Now, I know from personal experience that back in the 80s and early 90s, the U.S. Air Force was building some kind of massive base in Antarctica. The reason I know this is that I was in Auckland, New Zealand at the time, and they were transporting huge amounts of materiel out of that airfield at Auckland to the point that local people were becoming furious over the noise that the jets made at night because they only worked on this at night. So do you have any thoughts about this kind of thing, about some kind of interface between us and others?
I vaguely remember what you're talking about, but I really don't know anything specific at all.
Okay, so then we can't go down that road. But let me ask you another question. Could it be something to do with fear? Because you mentioned in the book, one would wonder if something terrified them. And that gets me to a memory of the things like the Forrestal suicide and other things that I know. And, you know, of course, I live with the visitors every day of my life, and it's taken me a long time not to be absolutely terrified of them, because they are, in fact, terrifying. In fact, within the past few weeks, they have communicated to me a couple of really terrifying threats. They're very determined, and they're very different from us. They don't say, you ought to do this. They say, you shouldn't do that. So what about terror being used as a means of control here? I mean, at a high level.
Yeah. I think I mentioned that could it have resulted from fear. And that was something I was wondering about, is that if the government did, I was afraid, you know, I was thinking that I didn't know, write it all out, but maybe they suggested to the people that were studying UFOs that something might happen if they go on and keep on studying this the way they are, or if they didn't quit, or that sort of thing. I just couldn't. There just wasn't enough information. I just speculated on the subject because I just couldn't understand why they stopped the study when they did.
Yeah, exactly. It is something. There's something there. There's a reason that it's not that the study did not produce results. It is that the study did produce results, and then they pulled back. That would be accurate, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And of course, I also wondered if the study that they did at Mattel was over the was about the Blue Book data that they collected when they did their investigations, and that was a secret study. And the only reason anybody found out about it was because there was a leak called the Pinnacle Memo. And I just wondered if maybe they stopped, or maybe it went really far underground where they could really control everything and no leaks would get back out.
But you have to wonder why. What motive would we have if there's no outside enforcement? What motive would we have to keep it secret? And that gets me to the whole idea of what might be being found. And I want to talk a little bit about, ask you if you know anything about research into gravity waves, for example.
Oh, I read the latest science. I read science journals and that sort of thing. And quantum mechanics is pretty amazing, too.
Because I know of accounts from UFO witnesses who have been inside these things that suggest to me, even though the witnesses don't understand exactly what they're talking about, that these things they generate their own gravity. And if you look at the video that was released by Lou Elizondo in December of last year, the Navy Department video of the thing that's moving, it's obviously not aerodynamic. It's functioning in some completely different way. And so I think they might have gained control over gravity. And maybe a reason for the secrecy would be that if we could uncover a secret like that, it would be so important to us, and it maybe in terms of weapons and propulsion, maybe this is the reason. I don't know.
I don't know either, and I speculated in my book that UFOs, they're generally thought of like airplanes, an advanced airplane, you know, that flies here from other planets and stuff. But they may be something totally different and a lot different from what we are. I mean, some people said maybe they're black matter or dark matter, whatever it's called, has its own evolutionary way of evolving into maybe intelligent beings, if we're intelligent, I should add. But that maybe the phenomena may be something just totally different and not like our physical existence.
Well, that sounds possible. And it's really that they could maybe even disrupt our world if we came into direct contact with them on a large scale.
Now, well, that's why I speculated that maybe there's some kind of a threat that if they keep on doing something that they could really cause a lot of trouble. They said, you know, the problem is traffic jams. Well, the problem isn't traffic jams. The problem is something that that actually exists.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the leak of the Pentacle Memo and what the Pentacle Memo was. Can you tell us about the Pentacle Memo?
Yeah, well, they were doing the study at Battelle, and they were coming up with good statistics and data. And as I said, the statistics later showed that a very, very high probability that UFOs are a real phenomenon, that they're real. And I think it was the CIA wanted to quell that before they even got the data. And so they convened something called the Robertson Panel, where they had all these big specialists on all kinds of fields that were notable scientists and everything. They didn't know a thing about UFOs, but they, you know, had big names, and they were going to study UFOs. And so far as I could tell, the purpose of that was to just quell the whole thing and say they don't exist. And so they had this study, and the secret study was going on at Battelle at the same time. And somebody, some leaker, or maybe a group of leakers, didn't like the idea that they were going to have the panel meeting before Battelle had the data. And this was high-level stuff, too, because the president of Battelle was on one of the people on the Pentacle Memo, and the other words, specialists or supervisors. And so they asked to not have the panel convene until they had the data. But instead they had the panel convene anyway before the data and said, you know, UFOs are nothing, don't worry about them, they don't exist and all that. It was the findings of the panel, and they didn't have the data. So it was a pretty artificial setup.
Yeah, and it's like there's somebody telling somebody from above, close this down.
Yeah, and somebody, you know, people on the inside knew about it, were very unhappy about that, because not only might have this had something to do with UFOs, but also with Battelle's reputation, because they were supposed to be providing the information to the Robertson panel, and the Robertson panel acted without the full information, which, you know, could reflect back on Battelle. And so they weren't very happy about that, even though they didn't want to really be associated with UFOs. They didn't want the data to look like they'd done something wrong either.
Yeah, of course. And so, and what exactly did the Robertson panel say?
I just in general, that UFOs don't exist. There's nothing about them. It, well, it said they don't affect national security, which isn't exactly the same as saying they don't exist.
Yeah, it's a very, very critical distinction, though.
Yeah.
Because they are not saying that they don't exist. They're saying that it's not a national security issue, meaning that they could know that they exist and also know enough about them to know that they're not a national security issue.
Yeah, that didn't make sense to me either, because how would they know if they didn't know anything about them, whether they had anything to do with national security?
Well, if they are being controlled by whoever comes out of them, then, and that person, those beings are saying, you say this, that's what's going to be said, and it may not be true.
Yeah. And both the Robertson and the Condon Committee, which both were just fake things set up to debunk UFOs by the government, both said there's no effect on national security and insinuated by that that there's no UFOs.
Right. Well, you know, I knew Walter Orr Roberts, who was the president emeritus of NOAA, and he told me he had been approached by the Air Force to head what became the Condon Committee, and they told him frankly that the outcome of the study was already decided, that they would say what they said, that there was nothing there. And he refused to do it because he said, what's the point? It's a complete cover-up. But Condon, whom he knew well, agreed and did it. But it was not, the purpose of it was never to study UFOs or to gather data. The purpose of it was to say there was nothing there. But that's not quite true in terms of what's actually in the study, is it?
No, that was true of everything. In the Condon Committee report there, they couldn't explain about one-third of their data, but they still went ahead and said that UFOs, you know, more or less, paraphrasing it, that UFOs don't exist, which is ridiculous scientifically, because if you can't explain one-third of your data, you can't come to a conclusion like that.
No, absolutely not. But we have here is folks, as you're listening to this, what you're listening to is a discussion about various points at which this study was shut down on the inside, because we're talking now to someone with an above top secret security clearance who actually witnessed a process of this information being closed off from her level of activity. Now, I've speculated that it could be that there are aliens here who do not want to be studied. And if that's the case, then there's something very strange going on in this studio right now. Just hold on a minute. Okay, I'm going to continue on. That there could be something here that is a higher level of control. But we don't have any evidence of that, do we, Irina? I mean, nothing direct.
No, just a lot of smoke, but no fire at all that
right.
I know of.
No fire at all. Let's talk about J. Allen Hynek. It's an absolutely fascinating part of your book is about J. Allen Hynek. Could you tell us a little bit about this man, since obviously he's a principal figure in the Blue Book series on the History Channel. What was he like?
Well, I hope my book introduces him to people. He has tons of scientific writings, and they show his thoughts and everything about UFOs and particular things, but they don't really show his personality. And I have a number of his documents and letters that he wrote that just are informal, handwritten letters and that sort of thing. And they show a totally different side of him. And I was pretty amazed. I mean, you sort of felt like you knew him after you read his letters, which you wouldn't from reading his scientific studies. And he seemed like he was real charming. He had a real good sense of humor. He was sort of like Mark Twain. He sort of explored things from a different angle and saw things from a different angle. He was very interested in everything that all the current events. And I was just really impressed with his sense of humor, because he seemed to be in good spirits most of the time and would joke around and that sort of thing. So I had a good impression of him. And also, a lot of people have criticized him and said that he was just a peacock. He wanted his name in the paper and everything like that. But the letters show that he was really concerned about UFOs. I mean, after he stopped being a debunker, that he wanted to take a real good scientific study, and he wanted to, he went out on his own and interviewed people and paid for it himself and spent a lot of time investigating. He was very sincere in his interest in UFOs. He wasn't just, you know, peacock or something.
Yeah, I didn't know him. He was very ill when I came into this, but Bud Hopkins knew him quite well and told me what he had been like as a person. And there's not any evidence that he was anything but what he said he was. And
I thought he was completely sincere.
Yeah, I did too. So. Now, let's go on. I want to return to the things like the SR-17 affair. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, that was a study done by Battelle of the data that came in from Blue Book after they did their investigations. And Battelle, they devised a questionnaire in such a way that they could get real discreet information from the witnesses about their sightings. Like it would ask, how many objects are you seeing? You know, it write the history of what you saw, when and where, and the azimuth of what you saw and the apparent diameter, and just all kinds of questions in a way that people can understand it, but that had scientific meanings. And then they took all that data from the questionnaires, which was discrete data that you could, you know, get a good handle on, study like how many and how many minutes and you watched and things like that. And that's what they used on the SR-14, the Battelle study that was secret. And using that, they did statistics on it. And that's where they found that just beyond anything you could imagine in scientific statistics, that the UFO phenomenon is real.
Yeah, exactly. But then what happens? It goes nowhere.
Well, that's the trouble, is the other studies were fake, in my opinion. I mean, the outside part of Blue Book and the Robertson and Condon.
They're obviously fakes.
But this one was an actual study, and it's the one nobody knows about. Which after they got the statistics, they tried to manipulate them, and I went through and calculated a bunch of the statistics again, and I thought there was a much higher, lower probability level than even they reported, much higher. But that's the one nobody's ever heard of. And it was presented as finding nothing in its summary, whereas actually it found a whole lot.
It's really fascinating and very disturbing. Now, you say in the book, from my own experience, I have found UFOs to be a threat to national security as follows. And then you go into your classified position at GS, your PhD level in DIA. And why, could you tell us a little bit about the why behind that conclusion?
Well, my sister and I had a long, what brought it into this is that my sister and I had a long UFO experience together. And as we were undergoing this experience, someone tried to kill us. I mean, it certainly seemed to me like I was going to die.
Can you get into a little bit of detail of exactly where you were and what was happening?
Okay. I was working for the DIA in Washington, D.C., and she was taking postgraduate work at Drew University in New Jersey, and we were on the east side of the coast. And so we decided to go up and see the New England states and, you know, take a vacation and things. And so I took some coworkers and went up, and they left and went to New York. And I took some pictures of them with her in her dorm. And I picked her up, and we went to Boston. And it was daylight when we got there. And so we decided to go up and look around some more New England states. And so we went up Route 3 into New Hampshire and drove a ways into New Hampshire. I found out later this was where the Betty and Barney Hill thing had happened. We drove through the area. But we drove back to Boston. And I was on the outer belt, and I went on Route 9 into the interior part of Boston because I wanted to get, you know, right in the middle of the city and find a place to stay. And all the hotels were closed. And so we were coming back out on Route 9, and my sister kept, we could see this very strange light south of us. It looked like it was going down Route 95. And my sister kept saying, this is weird. And I kept saying, it's a helicopter. It was blinking. It was real low. We could see there was an airport, Norwich Municipal Airport, south of us. And we could see the planes coming in from the east and landing at the airport. And, you know, they put their landing lights on, and they had red lights and everything. We could see them. And this was below, lower than their apparent height. And so we were from a real family that didn't talk about UFOs. We were Midwest, and you didn't talk about strange things. But we both admitted to each other that we had seen UFOs, and we'd seen something together before that when we were just kids that we didn't understand. But anyway, we both confessed to each other we'd seen UFOs, and so we kept following it. And I got on Route 95, and I was driving through a woods. I don't know if there's one there now or not, but there was a light in the woods. It wasn't very far from the car, maybe 50 feet or something in the woods, and it was going through this series of color changes of different shades of red and different shades of blue, and it was just going through a spectrum like it was rotating. And as we went by it, the inside of the car lit up in green, and I didn't understand that at all, and I looked all over. I couldn't find a beam anywhere. The light wasn't green, and I had no idea why the inside of my car would light up in green. And so we kept on driving, and we continued arguing because I couldn't imagine what it was because it was fairly obvious. And, you know, I thought if this was a UFO, all the TV stations and everything else would be out reporting on it. And so anyway, my sister, after a while, started shrieking at me to stop, stop. And she said it was going to go over the car. And so I pointed my finger out the car window, and I was going to say, see, it's a helicopter. This has appeared, and I saw something that looked like a shooting star. And then the object came over the trees, and I realized at that time my sister was right. It was low and slow, and it had seven things on the side that looked just like windows. They were squares, and they were blinking in a sequence. And anybody would probably say, oh, that's a blimp. Well, we grew up on a farm with a freeway through it, and it was a blimp route. And so we saw blimps by freeways all the time with, you know, lighted sides and everything else. And I have lots of videos of them. And we were completely familiar with blimps and airplanes too. And so this thing was going over, and I had a camera in my back seat and film in my trunk that was high-speed film. It was a Polaroid. You didn't have a lot of high-speed things back then, but I did. And so it took me a while to load the camera because it was a Polaroid. You have to go through some procedures and everything. And so anyway, I had the camera just ready to take a picture, and I was just amazed because we could see inside this object. And I thought, nobody has a picture of the inside of a UFO. And I thought this was great. And just then a truck driver came and parked in front of our car and walked up to me. And I thought, I had another witness, and I thought, this is great. And he asked what we were looking at. And of course, I didn't say UFO or anything like that, but there was an airport. I pointed and said, what's that? Like, it was a type of airplane. Well, he just rotated around exactly the opposite direction from where I pointed and looked at the same altitude and everything, said, I don't see anything. And then he rotated back and asked me the same question. And I gave him the same answer. And he rotated back around, looked in the opposite direction, said, I don't see anything. Then he rotated around to face me again. He was standing right beside me and pointed to his head like I was insane and went back to his truck. And that was pretty weird. And then the object that we were watching started circling the airport. And we both were sort of amazed by that because the airplane stopped landing. They were kind of up above it circling. And so anyway, I wanted to keep on trying to see if I could figure out what it was. We both did. And I didn't know what direction it would go after it stopped circling the airport. So I decided to turn my car around. So I got back on the freeway and I was going to the next interchange and turned my car around in case it went the other direction. I don't know why I thought that, but anyway, the truck driver got right in behind me, got right on my bumper, turned his bright lights on so that I couldn't see. I mean, he was shining him right in the mirror and I couldn't get rid of him. I tried to switch lanes and everything and he would just stay right on my bumper and I was blinded and I didn't know what to do. I thought we were going to get killed and I was just pressing on the accelerator as fast as I could go because I thought, you know, cars are lighter and he's a heavier truck, but he just stayed right on my bumper. And finally, I decided from the left side of the road that I would swerve off to the next intersection. And I told my sister to watch, and she couldn't seem to see. And I don't think she realized how much danger we were in. But anyway, I swerved, and if somebody had been coming up faster on the right-hand lane, we'd have been dead. But I got off the intersection and then came back. And we'd gone a number of miles. It wasn't the first intersection. We came back, and it was still circling. And so then it started heading toward the northwest. And I followed it up, and I came to the same place where that light had been. And again, the inside light of the car turned green. And on some other roads, and it kept going northwest, and the roads went east and west and north and south. So I started zigzagging, and finally I got on this real old, beat-up, bumpy road, gravel, with houses a long ways away from each other, where you couldn't really turn around, and it was very hard to drive on, and the object was just going a little bit faster than I could go with my car, and so I finally turned around and went home. I mean, we went back to New York.
Well, listen, we have thankfully come to the end of the hour intact. I haven't said anything about what's been going on over here. I alluded to it once earlier in the show, but there have been bells ringing and all kinds of things happening in this studio that don't make any sense at all. I don't know if it was picked up. The microphone is highly directional, so I don't think so. But folks, if you listen close, you might hear some of it. It has just been weird. Irina brought something with her. No question about that. No. So here we have a discussion with a person who has been behind the scenes. And believe me, we just scraped the surface. Get sacred corridors. I don't often do this. But, you know, if you want to be informed, and information is critical because this is going to change only when we are informed and we understand. Sacred Corridors takes you down that road a good distance. So get it. Irina, thank you so much for being with us this week. And next week, Irina will be back to discuss Inside the Lightning Ball, scientific study of lifelong UFO experiencers. And as one myself, I know this is a darn good book. Thank you for being with us, Irina, and everybody, wait for next week if you can. It's going to be great.
Well, thank you very much. I'm certainly glad I got to get on your show and tell what I know.
Yeah, me too.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.